This following tape is about evolution. It is given by Ron Carlson at Hume Lake, California, in July of 1978.
We have been following Peter's admonition this week in 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 15, where he tells us that as Christians, we are to be ready always to give to every man an answer, a reason for the hope that lies within us. And this is what we have sought to do, and I trust it's been helpful. Tonight we want to deal with the subject of secular humanism, evolution, and the decline of America. If you have your Bibles, turn with me to 1 Corinthians chapter 1. 1 Corinthians chapter 1, beginning with verse 18. For the word of the cross is to those who are perishing foolishness, but to us who are being saved, it is the very power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and the cleverness of the clever I will set aside. Where is the wise man? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world through its wisdom did not come to know God, God was well pleased through the foolishness of the message preached to save those who believe. For indeed Jews ask for signs and Greeks search for wisdom. But we preach Christ crucified, to Jews a stumbling block, and to Gentiles foolishness. But to those who are the called, both Jew and Greek, Christ the power of God and the wisdom of God. Now we want to take off from verse 21. Paul says that the world, through its own wisdom, has not come to know God. And this is precisely what we want to see tonight, that the world in its wisdom has never been able to come to know God. It's been very much like the story that C.S. Lewis tells about the wise mystical barnacle sitting down at the bottom of the ocean one day. And in a moment of mystical enlightenment, this barnacle gathered his barnacle buddies around him and began to expound upon the nature of man. He said, man has no shell. Man is not attached to a rock. And man is not surrounded by water. Oh, a few of the barnacles got an idea of what man was like. But as time went on, they began to assume that since man had no shell, he must be a shapeless blob of jelly. And since man was not attached to a rock, he must have no location where he lives. And since man was not surrounded by water, it was quite obvious that he did not eat since he had nothing to float food to him on. The barnacles came to realize that this type of creature was far less active and definite than barnacles. And we have the same problem, beginning with our finite nature, in seeking to comprehend the infinite God without any revelation of who He is. And in the universities today, whether you study the philosophy of religion or the anthropology of religion or the psychology or the sociology of religion, they are all seeking to begin with man in his finite nature, and to work outward from that to seek to comprehend the universe and the nature of God. And the problem is that it is like a barnacle trying to comprehend the nature of man. And like barnacles come up with a gross distortion of what man is, so man left alone in seeking to comprehend God can do the same thing and end up worshiping a God far less than who God really is. And so we find that when you deal with the basic philosophy today, which is permeating all academic disciplines in our universities and which has permeated all of society, that is secular humanism, many people are not aware of the dangers of it. Humanism is very much like a noxious gas, a poisonous gas, which you cannot see, you cannot smell, you cannot feel, and oftentimes are never aware of its presence until it's too late. And so we want to deal with this important subject tonight. Now, in dealing with secular humanism, and I define humanism simply as the philosophy that arose in the 19th century that stated that there is no God, that man is supreme, man is the height of evolution, and man can solve all his problems without any reference to a supreme being. Now, back in the Renaissance, the word humanism developed, but back in the Renaissance it referred to a rise of renewed interest in the classical languages, the arts, the humanities, but in the 19th and 20th century, humanism took on a new meaning, and this is what we're talking about tonight. Those who say that there is no God, that man is supreme, that man can solve all his problems. And what we had arising in the 19th century was a scientific naturalism. Now, it's interesting that as you study philosophy and the philosophy of science, that the philosophers and scientists of the last 150 years have never disproved the existence of God. What the philosophers did was to simply set up a definition so small that God did not fit. What they did was to establish a three-dimensional box. And when we talk about science, science is based upon two things. It's based upon observation and experimentation of a real world, a material world. And science is limited to that three-dimensional box that they can observe and experiment in. When we talk about three dimensions in science, we're talking about height, depth, and width of our material world. And naturalism is limited to that box. And many philosophers came to say in the 19th century that there was no God. Now, you must understand that they never disproved the existence of God. They simply defined him out of existence with a definition so small that God did not fit. This is how David Hume did away with miracles, supposedly. David Hume, who 90% of the arguments against miracles can be traced to this British empiricist. What he did was simply to set up a definition so small that he said the only thing that exists or the only thing that is real is that which we can observe or experiment with in our naturalistic system. And since miracles don't fit that box, miracles can't exist. But the problem comes is this, that God is far bigger than all our little boxes. And God is far bigger than all our little definitions and formulas. God may be 4, 5, 6, 10, 100 different dimensions beyond our three-dimensional world. And this box does not limit God in any way. He is the creator of that box. He himself is not part of it, though he works in and through it and has revealed himself to us, as we're going to see in a moment. But because of this basic philosophy that arose that said there was no God, man found himself in a great dilemma. In the 19th and 20th centuries, we found this whole philosophy and idea coming to the fore. That there was no God, man was supreme, man was alone on the universe, he was in the process of evolution and evolving physically, that he must evolve also mentally and socially and spiritually to achieve his own divinity. And this began back, and we won't go into all the history of it, but with Hegel, who lived at the beginning of the 19th century, who taught his dialectic and really was the father of modern relativistic logic, which we won't get into. But after that, man began to teach there was no God. Ludwig Feuerbach, the German philosopher, put it this way. He said, Christians are the true atheists because they deny the deity which is themselves. And at this point in the 19th century, man was saying that man was God himself. There was no supreme deity. Man was alone on the universe. He was evolving. He was God himself. And this produced a great optimistic humanism in the 19th century. But this was quickly shattered when we entered the 20th century by two world wars and a depression. And this utopia that man felt he could build by himself was shattered, and he fell into despair. And out of this despair, there arose a new philosophy called existentialism. And existentialism simply deals with the meaning of existence. and men like Jean-Paul Sartre and Albert Camus and Heidegger and Jaspers said that the only meaning that one has to life is what you give yourself, that there is no supreme being, you're alone on this world, and you must do something to give your life meaning. For Carl Jaspers, the Swiss philosopher, he said, the only thing that gives meaning to life is death. And when you die, then you will have achieved meaning and purpose. For Jean-Paul Sartre, the French existentialist, he came to realize, he said that a finite point without an infinite reference point becomes meaningless and absurd. A finite point man, if he has no infinite reference point in God, that ultimately life becomes meaningless and absurd. There's one problem with this. Man could not live with absurdity. But throughout the 40s and 50s, and even into the 60s, we see this philosophy developing in the arts and literature that everything was absurd. Life had no meaning. Man was alone, he's born, he dies 50, 60, 70 years later, and who cares? It's all meaningless and absurd. And many people today feel just like that. On university campuses, your neighbors, that life has no meaning. In a recent article in the International Literary Quarterly, they did an article on the theater of the absurd to illustrate this. And they had an interesting paragraph. They said, quote, "We live in a world without coherence and without certainty. In coming to terms with it, the absurd has ceased to be absurd at all and has become the climate of our everyday life. That for many people, meaninglessness and absurdity in life is simply an everyday process. And they die, and who cares?" This is illustrated in the theater and music. You see it all the time. There's a musician called John Cage who's known as the musician of the absurd. I went to one of his concerts in Golden Gate Park in San Francisco. He did something very interesting. He had a brand new $9,000 Steinway grand piano out in the middle of the park. And then he had microphones feeding into this grand piano, and they were plugged into amplifiers outside. Then he doused the whole thing with gasoline and set it on fire. And as this brand new Steinway grand piano went up in flames, the crackling and springing of the strings amplified out as music to those standing around. And it's interesting that day, as people were standing around, everybody said, "Hey, that's absurd." John Cage looked at him and he said, "Ah, you got the point. Life's absurd. It's all meaningless." And this is how many people felt in the 50s. But man could not live with his absurdity. He could not live with a meaningless existence. And so in the 1950s, there developed a philosophy expounded by Aldous Huxley that if you drop a little mescaline, a little acid, LSD, smoke some dope, you can expand your inner awareness and achieve some reality within yourself. Aldous Huxley died on mescaline in 1957 in Hollywood, but that philosophy was then taken over by his devotee, Timothy Leary, former professor at Harvard, who began to expound that if you simply take some LSD and mescaline and smoke some dope, that you will be able to expand your inner awareness and find meaning within yourself. Well, I don't have to tell you what happened to the drug culture. People did not find meaning within themselves, but at this time, people were desperately looking for meaning, not only within themselves, but in other people. I'll never forget Haight-Ashbury, in the mid-60s, where all the young people were going to go and build a utopia, peace on earth. And they were going to show the adults how to establish a utopia. Well, if you go to Haight-Ashbury in San Francisco today, it's just a signpost that says Haight and Ashbury. And all the people are gone. What happened to this love culture where everybody was going to build a utopia? Well, there's one problem. Everybody went there looking for the same thing. They were all empty people looking for love, but there was nobody there to give it. And instead of loving each other, they began to rip each other off with bad drugs, and it became a very ugly scene. And because young people could not find meaning within themselves through drugs, they could not find it in other people, people began to say, well, maybe we need to go a step below human beings. Maybe we need to go a step lower to nature. Maybe we'll find meaning and purpose in life on the level of nature. And so, at the end of the 60s and beginning of the 70s, we had the whole ecology movement spring upon us. Get back with nature. Love nature, and nature will love you, and you'll find meaning and purpose. I had two friends during this time who moved up to Yreka, California, to live in a teepee and to get back with nature. And I just saw them recently, and I asked them how it was getting back with nature. And they said to me, "Well, you know, Carlson, you really get tired of eating wild berries and roots all the time." And they said, "You know, we can't understand." They said, "We try and love nature, and nature turns around and is very violent. We try and love it, and we can't understand why 1,000 people are destroyed in an earthquake in Honduras or 10,000 in a typhoon in Bangladesh." They say, "Nature, don't you love us?" And nature was very violent. Because they could not find meaning on the level of human beings, they could not find it in nature, many people thought, well, maybe we need to go under nature into the supernatural. And so many people went into the Eastern cults looking for the answer to life. For many people, Eastern philosophy was the answer to the ecology crisis. Pantheism, that we're all one with the universe, we're one with nature. The reason we love nature is because we're one with it. But as we shared Sunday morning, there's one problem with that. In pantheism and Eastern philosophy, you never raise nature to the level of human beings. You always end up devaluing people to the level of nature. Man becomes equal with dirt. But many people thought in the Eastern cults they would find it, whether through the Hare Krishnas or the Divine Light Mission or TM. And our world was philosophically ripe for the coming of the Eastern movement. Life was absurd. You need to go within. Drugs didn't do it. Maybe meditation will. Dive within yourself. Try and find some existential meaning within yourself. When they didn't find it there, many people now are going heavily into the occult, seeking wisdom and knowledge and power from some source other than God outside of our three-dimensional world. And you'll find something very real there if you delve into it, but it'll destroy your life. People are desperately today looking for something that will give meaning and purpose to life. What we see happening on the university campuses now is total apathy setting in. People have tried everything, and they've turned simply to a hedonistic, materialistic way of life to seek to find meaning. Just live for yourself, find pleasure only for yourself, and care only for yourself. This has become the prominent status of our society today. And what is going to happen after this is we're going to see an increase, I believe, in violence as never before across our country as selfishness and greed reign supreme. And as Christians, we need to understand this whole philosophy because this philosophy is based upon a theory known as evolution. And it permeates every academic discipline in our schools all the way from the first grade on up through university. And for that reason, we'd like to look at that tonight. But as we begin, turn with me to Romans chapter 1. Romans chapter 1. Verse 18. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. 1 Corinthians, Paul tells us that the world in its wisdom has not come to know God. The world in its wisdom, based upon their scientific three-dimensional world, never came to know God because they boxed themselves into a three-dimensional box. They set up a definition so small that they could never find God. This is why I get a kick out of people who say you Christians have blinders on your eyes. Well, actually, it's the other way around. It's the humanists who have blinders on their eyes and who have boxed themselves into a little definition. As a Christian, I say, I'm not simply boxed into three dimensions. There may be 4, 5, 6, 100 different dimensions. And wherever we explore into the macrocosms of astronomy or microcosms of biochemistry, wherever we discover truth, it will be consistent with the nature of God. We don't have to fear to delve into those areas of study. because God is the God who created this world. He's the God of truth. But the humanist has limited himself by his own definition. And Paul says the world never came to know God in its own definition. And he says in Romans 1:18 that the world in its wisdom has suppressed the truth, he says, in unrighteousness. And this is what we're seeing today in our schools, that the humanists are suppressing the truth as a conscious activity in unrighteousness. And I want to demonstrate that tonight as we go in to the study of evolution. I took 5 courses in evolution on the graduate level at the University of California and Cal State Hayward for the purpose of finding out what are the evolutionists really teaching today. I'll never forget one class I had. I walked in the first day of class into my professor's office, and she had on her bulletin board one of these time-life charts, you know, of all the monkey men, all the way from Zinjanthropus, Africa erectus, Australopithecus, evolving upwards through Neanderthal, Cro-Magnon, and Homo sapien. You've seen these charts. They got them pinned in all the elementary and junior high schools around the country. And so I walked over to the bulletin board, and I just started laughing. Oh, man, that's really funny. Oh, man, look at... She said, what's so funny? I said, look at teacher. I said, somebody pinned this up on your bulletin board. Man, that's really funny. She said, what's so funny about it? I said, some kid must just stuck this up as a joke. She said, that's no joke. I put it up there. I said, ah, come on, professor. I said, nobody believes that anymore. She says, what do you mean? Of course we do. I said, ah, come on, professor. I said, you know that's a nice 19th century theory. It's been totally destroyed by 20th century science. Well, that was the first day of class. We had a great semester together. But it's interesting how evolution has become the basis of all academics today, from first grade on up through graduate school. And I want you to think with me tonight what the theory of evolution does to kids. I was speaking at Forest Home last year, and an 8-year-old kid came up to me, and we had been talking about this in a session, and he was with his parents, and the 8-year-old boy said he was convinced that he came from monkeys. And I said, where'd you get that idea? He said, well, I've been taught it from the first grade on up. And this is what they're teaching all the way from first grade, that kids are nothing but evolved monkeys. To show you how brilliant our federal government is, you know, we're teaching the kids are nothing more than evolved monkeys. And then last year, the HEW spent several thousand dollars of your tax money on a research project to figure out why kids act like it in the classroom. Well, it's not too hard to figure out if that's all you're teaching kids. You know, how it would change the Bill of Rights. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are descended from monkeys. Think about that. And I'd like to read for you what is advertised for all elementary schools to have in their library and in their classrooms. This is cut out of Time magazine, advertising their Time Life books on the emergence of man. You've all seen this advertised on television and Time and magazine. Let me read for you just a couple paragraphs of this advertisement, because this will give you a flavor of what kids are being taught, and think about what it does to their mentality in regards to the value of life, in the regards of the basis of morality, etc., etc. Time Life presents a spectacular series, The Emergence of Man. Begin with The Missing Link, yours to enjoy free for 10 days. Today, that creature who first ventured to raise himself above the other animals no longer exists. He has become you. Unique, set apart from the 2 million other species living on the planet, by a thumb that makes your hand a precision tool, by a knee that locks you into a comfortable upright position, and by your capacity for abstract thought and speech. All this and more has enabled your species to dominate the earth. And yet you share with every other creature that ever lived the same origins, the same accident that led to the spontaneous creation of the first single-cell algae 3.5 billion years ago. Isn't that exciting? To know that You're nothing but an accident, evolved from a single-cell slimy algae. Now think about a kid or a child who grows up thinking that. What basis does he have for human value, or what basis does he have for morality, if he is nothing but an accident evolved from slimy algae? Goes on. How did it all happen? What was the evolutionary process that led to man and his conquest of a harsh and hostile environment? You will find the amazing story in Time Life Books' new series, The Emergence of Man. Your introductory volume, The Missing Link, shows you the stranger than science fiction world. That's an understatement. Of Australopithecus, the ape man. You'll feel a sense of immediacy and visual adventure in the incredible lifelike pictorial technique, photo painting. And then, you see, they show you. The books have what they call photo painting, pictures of the missing link and the ape man. It's amazing how many children in elementary school see these paintings and they say, wow, the guy must be real. Look, they got pictures of him. And we live in a very visual, stimulated society. If you can see it visually, it must be real. And kids go through these books. But what is the evidence for the theory of evolution? And I'd like to demonstrate to you tonight that the world of humanists are suppressing the truth in unrighteousness concerning the scientific evidence concerning evolution versus creation. First of all, what do we mean when we talk about theory of evolution? Those who teach the theory of evolution, and I'm not referring to a definition you'll find in a biology class. In a modern biology class, they have now used the term evolution to refer to natural selection, mutation, etc., etc. That's not what we mean. We're talking in terms of how they use it in paleontology and sociology. That evolution is an upward progression from non-living matter, inorganic matter. We don't know where that came from, they'll tell you, but that this evolved upwards to living matter, which evolved upwards to conscious matter, which evolved upwards to self-conscious matter, to gain ethics, values, aesthetics, upwards to gain a God consciousness, and that evolution has been a progression and evolution upwards from chaotic simplicity to greater and greater complexity and organization. Now, to begin with, you must assume a variety of things as an evolutionist. First of all, if you're taking a course in evolution, and if you're a college student here, take some notes tonight so you'll know how to drive your biology teacher up a wall. First of all, they must assume, where did this non-living matter come from? They never tell you that. They simply say, well, somehow it got here, a big bang or whatever. And then they must assume that somehow this non-living matter evolved to living matter. Now, Dr. George Wall, professor of biology at Harvard, who won the Nobel Prize in 1971, writing in Scientific American on the origin of life, made this statement, and I quote him. He said, when it comes to the origin of life on this earth, we have only two possibilities as to how life arose. One is spontaneous generation arising to evolution. The other is a supernatural creative act of God. There is no third way. He then goes on to say that spontaneous generation was totally disproved 100 years ago by Louis Pasteur, Spallanzani, and others. But he says that leads us to only one other possible conclusion, that life arose as a supernatural creative act of God. He says, I will not accept that philosophically because I don't want to believe in God. Therefore, he says, I choose to believe in that which I know is scientifically impossible, spontaneous generation arising to evolution. Now, what is spontaneous generation that all evolutionists hold to? It is the belief that life originated from non-living matter. Now, this was an idea held all the way back to the time of Greeks. You would put a piece of raw meat out in the hot sun, and over a period of days, that meat would spontaneously generate or produce maggots, which would turn into flies. Now, what is spontaneous generation that all evolutionists hold to? It is the belief that life originated from non-living matter. Now, this was an idea held all the way back to the time of Greeks. You would put a piece of raw meat out in the hot sun, and over a period of days, that meat would spontaneously generate or produce maggots, which would turn into flies. Or if you put some rags and cheese in a corner of a house, over a period of time, those rags and cheese would spontaneously produce mice. Or if you had a stagnant pond of water, over a period of time, that water would spontaneously produce low wrigglers, which would turn into mosquitoes or tadpoles or whatever you have. And this was an idea that was prevalent for a long time, that life arose from non-living matter. Well, it was only 100 years ago that Louis Pasteur came along and with a variety of experiments demonstrated that when you put some meat out in the sun, that the meat does not produce maggots and flies, but rather flies go there, lay their eggs, and produce maggots and flies. He demonstrated that if you have rags and cheese in the corner of a house, that the cheese does not produce mice. But mice smell out the cheese, they go and build their nest and have their young. The same with little wrigglers or tadpoles. And he demonstrated a basic axiom of biology, that life only arises from life. And so you begin, in dealing with evolution, you must have your professor explain the basic fallacy of spontaneous generation. All evolution believes that life arose from non-living matter. You must ask the question, how do you get non-living matter, or how do you get living matter from non-living matter? You must explain that before you go on. Well, they never do. They simply say assume. You must assume that somehow that took place, even though it's scientifically impossible, and we know that life only arises from life. Well, you have a variety of other problems, and we don't have time to go into it all tonight, but you have the problem of even beginning with amino acids, forming peptides, forming proteins. You see, the evolutionists, and this is what they teach in school, they say that billions of years back, there was a big inorganic ocean of nitrogens, ammonia, salts that were bubbling away, blah, 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 blah. And all of a sudden, poof, you had an amino acid. And somehow, over a period of time, there arose, poof, a second amino acid. And somehow those amino acids got together to form a peptide. And over a period of time, a bunch of amino acids got together to form a polypeptide, and a bunch of polypeptides over a period of time got together to form a protein, which itself is the building blocks of life. Now, Dr. Harold Bloom, a thoroughgoing evolutionist, says that the possibility for even the simplest peptide emerging to form a protein is virtually impossible. He says, for one peptide to arise, how do we know that a second peptide would not arise 2,000 miles away, 5 years later, and how would they ever get together to form a protein, which is not yet life, but simply the building blocks of life? He says the possibility to form even one simple protein is 6 times 10 to the 58th power, which is 6 times 10 is 600 octodecillion to 1, which in scientific language means it's virtually impossible. So the evolutionist says, well, you simply must assume this. We don't know how it happened, but assume it. Well, then you come to a very interesting argument that evolutionists use. And that is the argument that everything has been evolving upwards to greater and greater complexity. It's the physical law of the second law of thermodynamics, known as entropy. Now, entropy teaches, and the second law of thermodynamics teaches, that all energy and matter in the universe is in a process of decay and degeneration. And that, given a period of time, everything will decay and degenerate from organization to chaos. Let me give you an example. If you plant a garden back home, and you come up here to Hume Lake for 4 weeks, and you go home after 4 weeks, what is your nice, neat, organized garden going to look like?
Well, there are going to be weeds crawling all over it. It'll have gone from organization to degeneration and chaos. Wednesday's newspaper, if you saw Wednesday's newspaper on the back, and I forgot to bring it tonight, they had a picture of Philadelphia. Philadelphia has had a garbage strike for the last 5 days. And Philadelphia is producing entropy. They have gone from a state of organization and complexity downwards to total chaos and disorganization in 5 days. Because there is no intelligence acting upon the garbage. The second law of thermodynamics says that all matter and energy is in a process of decay and degeneration. If you buy a new Mercedes-Benz 450, stick it out in the woods here for 10 years, what will happen to that nice shiny chrome and car and everything else? It'll begin to rust, decay. And this is the second law of thermodynamics. Now, evolution says that everything is going from a process of chaos and simplicity upwards to greater and greater complexity and organization. Now that's what the evolution teaches. Now the second law comes along and says that everything is going the opposite direction. Everything goes from complexity downwards to chaos, which totally contradicts the possibility of evolution ever occurring. Now the evolutionist understands this. So he's come up with a brilliant argument. I love it because every time they use it, it destroys them. They now say, well, because second law of thermodynamics is in effect entropy and everything is in a state of tending towards chaos and disorganization, they say, well, for evolution to occur, what you need is a greater time span. You need to add a few more million years for things to randomly sort and select themselves and mutate themselves in order to produce complex organization. But you know what that's like saying, and I raised this in class one day, and it just destroyed the professor when I raised it. I said, Professor, I said, that's like saying that if I take an airplane up over Hume Lake, flying at 3,000 feet over Hume Lake, and I have in this airplane neatly stacked 10,000 3x5 cards, evolution would say that given enough chances, those neatly stacked 3x5 cards thrown out the window of this plane at 3,000 feet would filter down through the sky and spill out Hume Lake on the parking lot here in front of the administration building. Now you say that's crazy. They'll be flying all over the place. Well, the evolutionist knows that too. So he'll say, well, what you need is a greater time span, add a few million years for things to randomly sort, select themselves, and organize themselves. I said, Professor, I said, that's like saying that instead of flying at 3,000 feet, I'll now take the airplane to 25,000 feet. Man, now at 25,000 feet, when I push those neatly stacked 10,000 3x5 cards out the window, they will have a greater time span in which to randomly sort and select themselves to spell out Hume Lake on the parking lot of the administration building. What happens? They're going to be flying all over Fresno, Merced, Kings Canyon. Because it is a basic law of the basic law of the second law of thermodynamics that the greater the time span, the greater the chaos and disorganization. And so every time the evolutionist adds a few more million years, they're simply adding to defeating themselves. It is a basic law of physics. The greater the time span, the greater the disorganization and chaos. And the second law of thermodynamics totally refutes the possibility of evolution ever occurring. And to hold evolution, you have to go totally contrary to basic scientific evidence and facts. But they don't stop there. They go on to develop what I call Monkey Town USA, or the fallacy of the monkey men. And we had in Time magazine just last December on the cover, How Man Became Man. Here is Richard Leakey, the curator of the Nairobi Museum, who's taken over his father's work in the Olduvai Gorge in Tanzania, with Homo habilis. Now what's interesting to me is nowhere in this article do they tell you, see they got a picture of Homo habilis here, but they don't tell you that that is an African they put a mask on you know. But they say, here's Homo habilis, the missing link. Well, it's actually an African with a mask on. Well, in the article, they go for 7 pages trying to tell you that evolution is a fact. And then when you get to the last page of the article, let me find it here. It's really hilarious. They go through all these facts trying to prove that it is fact, and then they come to the last 2 paragraphs and they say this. But scientists concede that even their most cherished theories of evolution are based on embarrassingly little evidence, and huge gaps exist in the fossil record. They've just spent 7 pages telling you how factual it is, and the last paragraph they tell you, well, actually, we have embarrassingly little evidence, and huge gaps exist in the fossil record. But this, you see, children pick this up, university students, this is how it all is. Well, what have they done? They have developed this time-life chart that, going all the way back to Australopithecus, Australoafricanus, Africa robustus, Africa erectus, Pithecanthropus erectus, all the way up to Neanderthal, Cro-Magnon, to Homo sapien. Well, what is interesting is when you begin to study all of these monkey men that have been established. You see, what the scientists did was they had a dilemma. If you begin with the presupposition that there is no God, then you must explain somehow how we got here. And so in the 19th century, they came up with the idea of an evolutionary progression upwards. Well, even though 20th century science has destroyed that, they still cling to it because the only alternative, as Dr. George Wall says, is a belief in God, and they don't want to do that. They are suppressing the truth in unrighteousness, as Paul says. But in order to make their theory fit, they had to go out and try and find evidence to fit into this theory. So they had developed all of these so-called monkey men and evidence for them. Well, what is the evidence that they have discovered? Well, the first guy that we had was known as Pithecanthropus erectus, who they found in Java. Dr. Du Bois first found 2 teeth. The Americans say he found 3 teeth. They're not in agreement over that. Plus a skull cap and 1 jawbone. And this was said to be close to 1 million years old, one of the earliest monkey men. Well, what we later discovered, that Dr. Du Bois, at the turn of the century, had also found at the same strata, geological strata, he found Pithecanthropus, he also found 2 complete human skeletons of modern-day black aborigines. He hid those in a trunk for 23 years until National Geographic magazine looked into Pithecanthropus and discovered that he had hid these away and had not said anything about these 2 human beings at the same level, because it did not fit his evolutionary theory. And so he suppressed the evidence. And then we had, in Java, the Java man arise, which they dated 800,000 years old. Now, Java man was very interesting, because they put him together from bones they collected over a 26-mile riverbed. It was a regular human tinker toy factory down there. But out of this 26-mile area, they put together Java man. Highly unscientific. We then had the problem with the Piltdown man, who Charles Dawson discovered with a human head and an ape mandible or jawbone. And this was thought, and it was printed for 50 years in our textbooks, to be the missing link between man and ape. Well, it's now called the famous Piltdown hoax, when several chemists in the exact science tested the skull and the jawbone and found that it was of very recent origin, only a few hundred years old, and that it had been dyed with a chemical dye to make it look old. The paleontologists, of course, did not catch this, but it was the chemists who later detected that it was of recent origin and a fraud, and it's now called the Piltdown hoax, but it's been still in many of our books. Then we had the famous Nebraska man, and if you look on the time-life chart, you will see Nebraska man about the center of this chart, dating about 900,000 years old. Well, what they found in the Nebraska man was 1 tooth. That's all they found, 1 tooth. And then with plaster Paris, they built a head around him. They built an entire body around him with plaster Paris, built a society, a civilization around one tooth. It wasn't bad enough that they later discovered it was a tooth of an extinct pig. But I kid you not, the Nebraska man, look at one of those charts, is still published as scientific evidence. Now, what you have to realize when you go to college, students, when you go to university, that all these monkey men are plaster Paris. That they'll find a chip of bone, and they'll build a plaster Paris head, a plaster Paris body, a society, a civilization around this chip of bone. Now, I drove my professors bananas at the University of California. All you got to do is sit in the back of the classroom and raise your hand and say, "Professor, how do you get a whole head out of that tooth? How do you get a whole body out of that tooth? How do you get a whole society, a whole civilization out of that tooth?" You ask that enough time and they get very upset. But I had one professor at the University of California who confessed to me the last day of class. He said, "Ron," he said, "I've been teaching evolution here for 10 years. He had his PhD from the University of Davis, where they do most of the primate studies. He said, "Because you were in my class this semester, I've come to realize that evolution has no scientific evidence to stand upon." You just got to start asking questions and don't let them assume all the things they're assuming. We then had the Colorado Ape Man. They found one skull cap, they built a whole plaster Paris man around until they found it was an elephant's kneecap, so they had to get rid of him. Now, this is what's going on at the university level. We then have the famous Neanderthal man, and you all know about Neanderthal. What they found was a man in a cave in France who was stoop-kneed and bent over. And they figured that this was one of the earliest ape men who began to walk on 2 feet. He was stoop-kneed and bent over. And they figured that this was one of the earliest ape men who began to walk on 2 feet. He was stoop-kneed and bent over. Well, Dr. A.J. Cave at the International Zoological Convention in 1958 with a team of 50 scientists examined the famous Neanderthal man and discovered that the skeleton was only 150 years old, and that the man, a Frenchman, suffered from severe arthritis and rheumatism in the joints, and that's why he walks stoop-kneed and bent over. But Neanderthal man is still taught in all our textbooks. Then we had some interesting things occur in just the last few years. You know of Dr. Ellis B. Leakey, who excavated an Olduvai Gorge in Tanzania. Well, in 1961, he came up with a startling discovery. Up to this point, the earliest monkey man, the earliest ancestor, supposedly of man, was dated about 1 million years old. Well, he found 2 human skeletons, Homo sapien, cranium capacity the same, without a gorilla crest, same human jawbone, human teeth. He dated 1.5 million years old. Now, that created a terrible dilemma in 1961. What are you doing with a complete human 500,000 years before the earliest monkey man? That wasn't so bad, but in 1972, again in Olduvai Gorge, he uncovered again a Homo sapiens human skull and human bones, which he dated 2 million years old. What do you do with a skeleton of a human 1 million years before the earliest monkey man? Then we had, just 2 years ago, Dr. Olof Johansson of Case Western Reserve, excavating in the Far Valley in Ethiopia. He discovered 2 human skeletons, cranium capacity the same, jawbone, teeth human, the whole skeleton human. He dated 3 million years old. Well, that wasn't so bad. Along came last year Mary Leakey, the wife of LSB, and she found 2 human skeletons in Tanzania. She dated 3.3 million years old. What are you doing with humans 2.5 million years before the earliest monkey man? Dr. Richard Leakey, who is carrying on his father's work, who's here on Time Magazine, was lecturing last year at the University of California, San Diego. And a student asked him about this problem. He said, "What does it do to the theory of evolution?" Dr. Leakey said, "It destroys everything we ever thought about evolution." And the student said, "Well, what do we put in its place?" Dr. Leakey simply went, "I don't know." You see, what is happening, my friends, is that the world in its wisdom has not come to know God through their humanistic presuppositions. And so we are seeing today that they are suppressing the truth in unrighteousness. Instead of dealing with the scientific evidence and facts, they are teaching biased presuppositions. You must understand that when you go into the university and colleges, they are not teaching evidence, they are teaching biased presuppositions based upon humanism and evolution. And it's my argument not that creation or evolution, one or the other, should be taught in schools, but simply teach the evidence. Because the evidence scientifically points to a supernatural creator as an act of God. Now, there's a lot that we could say concerning this whole area of evolution, but our time is gone, so let's just conclude by saying several things. First of all, evolutionary humanism, as it is being taught, is going to have grave effects upon our nation if it is continually taught and the evidence is suppressed in unrighteousness. First of all, it's going to destroy human value. Secondly, we're going to lose our basis for morality, and we're going to lose all meaning to life. This is how young people are growing up today. First of all, we are losing our value for human life. You see, the Bible places a supreme value upon each individual. The Bible says that we are created in the very image of God, that God gave us minds to think with as He thinks, emotions to feel with and love with as He does, a free choice to choose what we want to do. In Psalms 139, verse 17 and 18, it says that God thinks about us continually, and His thoughts about us are so great that if you could count them, they would outnumber the grains of sand upon this earth. God says that you are of ultimate value in the universe, so valuable, Romans 5:8 says, that even while we were sinners, Christ died for us. Christ loved you and considered you of ultimate value, of ultimate worth, each individual. What is happening today with the theory of evolution is that life has become nothing but an accident evolved from slimy algae. That is why we have mass murder going on in our country under the title of abortion. You see, abortion is based totally upon the theory of evolution, that life is cheap, that we're simply an accident evolved from slimy algae, so who cares if we scrape out a fetus and flush it down the toilet because it's simply meaningless. My friends, that's a total mockery in the eyes of God when you realize the supreme value that God places upon each human life. When you begin to understand what God says about human life, you can no longer take it so cheaply. But based upon the theory of evolution, people have lost all human value. Not only that, but based upon humanism and evolution, we're losing our basis of morality and truth and righteousness and justice. All you have to do is look at the communist nations, which are based upon this philosophy that say there is no God. You know, if you look at the life of Gandhi, a lot of people say that Gandhi was a Hindu, that he had great value for human life. But if you read the biography of Gandhi, Gandhi will tell you where he got his value for human life. He was raised in a Christian missionary school in India. He went to the University of London, studied Western law and civilization based upon the teachings of Jesus Christ. He then went to Durban, South Africa as a lawyer and went back to India, and during the 1940s led the peace movement against the British. And finally, the British were forced to leave. You see, Gandhi understood the British mind based upon Christianity. And when he sat down with 300 Indians before those British troops, and the British troops would come through and begin to club them, finally the British were forced to leave because they could no longer treat humans that way. Now, do you think that if the communists and Russians were in India at that time, Gandhi would have done the same thing? You see, my friends, the communists showed what their value for human life is in 1956 in Hungary, 1968 in Czechoslovakia. My next-door neighbor is a refugee from Czechoslovakia in 1968. He lived in Prague, and he's told me how the students, seeking to follow Gandhi's example, sat down before the Russian tanks. But the Russian tanks simply rolled all over them and killed them. Because in a communist state there is no God, man is simply a cog in a great machine. The state is God. The state is supreme. And man loses all basis for human value. People often say, well, what about China? Look at how wonderful China has organized and fed its populations. What a great leader Mao Zedong was. My friends, there is no value for human life in China. Mao Zedong, in order to control a society, executed over 50 million Chinese. Sure, you can achieve an organized society by eliminating 50 million people, but you have no value for human individuals. My roommate 1 year in college was from Canton. He went back that year to China to his parents and told us how the state had taken over his father's business, how they lived in a literal police state. If they wanted to go to the next town, they had to report to the police, that they had no free choice of what they wanted to read or where they wanted to go. You see, a society based upon atheism destroys human value. It destroys all basis of morality. And Gandhi says in his biography, if you'll read it, he says his entire basis for human value he got from the New Testament and the teachings of Jesus Christ. Not from Hinduism, not from atheism, in Jesus Christ. And as our society loses that basis, we are going to see entropy take place in the value of life and the basis of morality. But to conclude, it's only in Christianity, my friends, and this is why we need to teach our children and speak so clearly in school and into our society, that God did not leave us in a three-dimensional naturalistic world. He did not leave us alone in a vacuum. But God has broken into our three-dimensional box of time and space. And he has personally revealed himself to us in human history so that we can know him and have life. When we look at Jesus Christ, my friends, it's in him alone that the world has a basis for human value. All you have to do is go around the world. Every hospital, every school, every medical clinic in Africa was started by Christians. Go to the Middle East. Every hospital, every school, every medical clinic was started by Christian missions. I've spoken at the University of Cairo, the University of Beirut. My friends, they're both Christian schools started by Christian missionaries, not Muslims. You go to India. Every school, every university, every hospital started by Christians, not Hindus. There are many Indians here working as engineers, teaching in our country. Ask them sometime where they got their education. They got it from a school that was started by Christians. Because, as you soon discover, it is only in Christianity that the world has a basis for human value. And nowhere else. No other philosophy, no other religion. Only in Jesus Christ. And this we need to proclaim loud and clear throughout the world. That is only in Jesus Christ that we see love. But more than that, this world was a creation of God. All the scientific evidence points to a supernatural creative act of God. That we are unique creations created in his image to live in a personal relationship with him. How vastly that different that is from being just an accident from a slimy algae. Oh, how we need to teach our children who they are, where they came from, and where they're going. Heavenly Father, these are very important issues that we've dealt with tonight, because our whole society, what we watch on television, what we see in movies and read in literature, we are continually saturated in school and everywhere else with a humanistic philosophy which denies God and is based upon evolution. But my God, we thank you that you did not leave us alone in a vacuum, that we can see the evidence of your creation throughout science and nature, that you broke into human history, verified for us who you are and how we can know you, that we can have life. We thank you that we are not meaningless creatures evolved from slimy algae, but that we are unique, created in your image. And more than the plants or the animals, you breathed in the man, the breath of life in man became a living soul. The unique ability to live in a personal relationship with you. And we thank you and love you tonight. Oh, may we teach our children, May we speak to our friends and neighbors and never be ashamed of the gospel of Jesus Christ, because it is good news. Good news in a lost and dying world. In Jesus' precious and holy name, we love you. Amen.